thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me, Dr. Mike. I really appreciate it. It was like when I first started taking my education in sports science, like you and Ben Esgrow from De Novo Nutrition were like the first two people I really gravitated towards. So it's like a huge honor for me to have you guys as like the first two podcast guests. So thank you so much.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
So I kind of wanted to take a little bit of a different approach with the Gym Spot Radio podcast. Like, so we're going to talk about the intersection between sport physiology and economic theory. I want to do that because, like, how many fucking times are you really going to talk about explain maximum recoverable volume? You know, like I feel like so many of these podcasts are just becoming the same thing. I want to try to offer something a little bit unique. So I guess where I want to start is you're actually a Russian immigrant, right?
Correct.
So I'd love for you to start. I've seen you post some stories that your parents have from living in Russia and dealing with some of the products of communism. So I'd love for you to start with why economics and capitalism is like important, like why people should give a shit and why it's morally important to you. I know you're a huge, I know you're a Soul fan, so.
For sure. Well, you know, there's a variety of arguments we could make as to its moral importance. If you're a big fan of individual freedom and individual rights, capitalism is a system of association in society that is based around individual freedom as its primary, valuation. So it's, anyone who's for individual rights automatically should have a lot of time for capitalism. And, that's all fine and good. To some extent, people can at least say they have different moralities or say they value different things. But, maybe not recently, but for a long time, I've been coming at the issue of, economic systems and what kind of people you vote for and what way you think society should be organized from a little bit of a different perspective than morality, because morality can be up for debate, blah, blah, blah.
Sure. People
can contradict themselves. We really have to ask a very just general question. What kinds of outcomes are we interested in, and what kinds of economic systems and the societies that employ them tend to produce those outcomes, and what kind tend to produce them a little bit less often? So
it seems like you're alluding to maybe innovation there a little bit, like incentive for innovation
to some extent. And that's certainly one of the bases of why capitalism, outperforms everything. But, I kind of just said it, capitalism outperforms everything. I can put that more formally. The things that most people want, societies that have freer markets and freer social policies, just tend to produce better and more reliably everywhere they're tried, with very few exceptions. For example, people generally tend to like clean water. People generally tend to like clean air. People generally tend to like a plethora of food choices, and for food prices to be cheap relative to how much money the average person makes. People generally tend to see that even the lowest rung of society is objectively well taken care of. We can get into debates about whether income inequality is a valuable thing to be looking at. But I don't think anyone's going to, disagree with the fact that a society in which the poorest people are billionaires, but the richest are trillionaires, I don't think anyone sees that as a bad society compared to where everyone's equal in income, but everyone lives day to day, half in starvation. So
right.
I think it's important to phrase that treatment of the poor being that the poor have objectively high standards of living compared to historical conditions and other global conditions. And also a society which promotes a variety of social freedoms, and a society in which you have access to a very solid stream of resources, and in which people tend to be happier. And all of those things that we want, we can think that any number of social systems get us to that goal. people who are subscribers to Marxist or socialist views are convinced that socialist organization of society is the best way to those things. The thing is, you know, yes, there are differences in what conservatives and liberals or what, you know, right-wingers and left-wingers at the more extremes want society to look like, but they also fundamentally agree on a lot. The perspective I'm coming from recently is the stuff that, you know, it's not like conservatives want not clean air and clean water, right, and liberals want clean air and clean water.
Yeah.
Nobody's for suffering. Everyone wants everyone to be very well off. You know, if everyone was infinitely rich, that would, nobody really going to argue against that. If everyone is infinitely happy, if medical care was infinitely great, I mean, those are all things that we can agree on. So if you check all the boxes of everything, pretty much all sane, normal people can agree on. And, you know, here's another example. Does everyone think it should be okay for a woman of reproductive age to walk around alone at night and not get assaulted? I think some people would prefer that women didn't do that, would be in their homes raising children, or why the hell is she out that late? But I don't think even those people would say it's a worse society in which a woman could do that if she chooses and be completely safe, right? So if we take all of those, you know, basically measurements and align them, we can ask them a very empirical question. What kind of societies around the world tend to do a better job of providing those, and what kinds tend to do a worse job? And the single best predictor of that is index of economic freedom, how economically free, how closely to capitalist principles a society structures itself. And to me, it's a pretty open and shut case. If you like what Australia, New Zealand, Hong Kong, Denmark, and the United Kingdom look like, if you, those are places you like to visit versus North Korea, Cuba, Venezuela, Turkmenistan, then you're onto something that is a very, very big deal in how people actually like to live their lives. And very few people move from the United Kingdom to Turkmenistan versus the other way around if they're allowed to do so. So it's another big deal, is everyone really agrees to this based on how they vote with their literal movement of their bodies.
Right. Well, I think, so to your point, I think the first thing about, you know, what a lot of, I think, people with socialist and communist economic ideology, done the reading, so to speak, on what happens. And you know, if you're the type of person to become a, you know, a communist dictator, those, it's probably not going to look as peachy as you want. Once I used to rant was, and kind of the foundation of economics and physics and hard sciences, I think in general, is reasoning from first principles versus reasoning by analogy. So you started with, well, you know, what do we all know is true? Everybody loves clean air, clean water, all of these things. And I think, you know, you and Renaissance Periodization are doing a great job with that as far as sports science concerned. Like when I first started hearing you talk about the concept of maximum recoverable volume, I was like, fucking duh. You know what I mean? But I could just never, like, I never just worded it. And it struck me a Paris fan at all.
Can you repeat that?
Can you hear me? Yeah. Are you a Sam Harris fan at all?
Huge.
So your kind of concept of maximum recoverable volume struck me similar to his, like, worst case scenario for everyone. As far as just like, okay, we have this kind of a vague concept of philosophical bedrock, but you can really extrapolate very concrete examples from that. So kind of reasoning from the first principle of, okay, what do we know to be true in that the worst possible suffering for everybody is bad, just like don't do more, you know, doing more work than you can recover from probably isn't going to be the best for your training, and then move along from, like, start there and then reason on up. And that's kind of economic thinking in a nutshell, I think. I generally want to talk about some of the principles in microeconomics, not so much macroeconomics, partly because it's not, I don't know, everybody has their own feelings on macroeconomics, but micro is a little bit more decision-making oriented. So I guess the first place I want to start is decreasing returns to scale and how that lends itself to the need for phase potentiation. Can you talk a little bit about your experience coaching athletes with how long different phases of training should last, generally speaking, you know, you have a hypertrophy phase and you have a decreasing returns to scale over maybe two or three or four blocks, and then you need to move on to something else because doing more work just isn't worth it.
Yeah, it's based on the concept of variation and also the fundamental physiological understanding that negative feedback loops are a feature of most physiological systems. They just are. Right. And negative feedback loops basically make it so that as soon as you start accruing a certain adaptation, the rate of accrual usually starts to slow down after a while, and you have to incrementally put more and more effort into gaining more of those adaptations. At some point, you get into a trade-off, which is very economically related, I think, of where if you're putting X amount of effort into getting Y amount of result, if you could do one half of X and get the same Y result in another fitness modality because you have, you know, you're starting to put so much to the thing that is so stale and so unresponsive, why not switch? So it kind of develops this idea that there are these hypothetical, and very, very well can't very much measure them, but we can try to estimate them. There are these hypothetical time frames of training particular fitness characteristics, after which training other fitness characteristics starts to become much more sort of lucrative because you can just get better returns on investment on those for a while. A simple example is just doing an exercise for hypertrophy. If you do squats all the time for hypertrophy, they work really well. And, you know, in sort of in trained athletes, they work really well. They work really well for, right away for more advanced or intermediate people. And then as the weeks go by, they work a little less well. And probably, you know, several months down the line, it would be very hard to say that, you know, advanced athletes are growing a lot from the same exercise. You strategically switch exercises, just as an example, you start to get really good growth out of this next exercise because of the idea of novelty. And again, you know, very much, you know, one of the derivatives of the principle variation. And then you milk that out for as long as it can. Now, the real trick is to sequence the modalities so that they are summative and that one builds on another. That's real phase potentiation, where one phase potentiates the next. What I just described is variation, which is a big part of phase potentiation. But phase potentiation really means, so we understand that there are fundamental fitness qualities, and then there are fitness qualities that are secondary to those. And luckily for us, the secondary ones are conserve the fundamental ones, but don't expand them. So strength training doesn't make you much bigger, but it really relies on muscle size to enhance the nervous system's ability to use that muscle. So what you do is you first build the size, then exploit that size with strength. I mean, a very easy economic analogy would be nothing happens as a society until rule of law is established. Or rule of law is actually the single most important principle of economic organization, and it's so taken for granted that no one even talks about that.
Private property rights.
Well, you can have whatever system of rights you like. If you don't have rule of law, it doesn't matter. So rule of law is first, whatever laws they are, if they're stable, well-enforced, and there's a low level of corruption, you're actually going to have quite a bit of economic growth just because of that. Because even if the business environment is not ideal, even if the government has an excessive amount of power, if it's a predictable, reliable amount of power that businesses can develop strategies to do their best in, then they start doing that. But if there's no rule of law, I mean, you have basically chaos and, well, you know, Somalia, Ethiopia, et cetera. So that's one of those things where basic fundamental principles or basic things that you build potentiate the effects of other things. And you have to get the order correct, because if you do strength training first, then hypertrophy after, you don't get much stronger because there's not much to change, not much to work with. And then you don't, you will get bigger, but at the end of that, your strength isn't up because your nervous system is not wired for strength expression. It's wired for hypertrophy. So doing it backwards is it's a different quality leap.
Well, so that brings me into the next point I want to talk about, is kind of increases in technology. So I wrote a little, and how that applies to strength athletes. So I made a little sweet graph, because in economics we love graphs, of kind of a production possibilities frontier curve. So for people not familiar, production possibilities curve, just you have your inputs along two axes, and then the curve represents all the things you can make with those different inputs, and the area underneath is like consumption bundles that you can make. So if you increase one input or both, the area underneath the curve is going to increase. And I think that's a great way to consider hypertrophy training for strength athletes. You know, you have a certain amount of strength. You say you have X units of strength, and then you increase your muscle mass, you will then have a higher potential for strength down the road. Now, there's some folks in the fitness industry right now, researchers that are not convinced of that principle, it seems. What do you think about that?
You mean Jeremy Lenicky or whatever his name is?
Yeah, I was trying not to say, you know, names, but he's been pretty vocal.
Yeah, I think he's ridiculous. I think he's ridiculous, and I think he's damaging the reputation of science, period.
Wow.
Yeah, very comfortable saying that. You feel free to quote me.
I always know how much of he seems to be. I mean, I don't know him personally, but he seems to be a pretty hardcore scientist. So, you know,
I mean, in the sense that he has a laboratory position and he does research.
His integrity towards the scientific method seems to be, he's very proselytizing about it.
Well, he seems to have misunderstood the scientific method, especially the component, the part about the external validity of his studies, which is, he's actually on record saying a variety of things, which should really just... There are very few statements you can make when someone can just completely write you off as a thinker, but some of them sort of certainly border on that. He said that pretty much all or almost all hypertrophy that people experience from training occurs within the first 6 months of training.
That seems pretty...
That's it. That's a standalone statement, which he has reiterated several times.
What makes him believe that?
I don't care. I don't give a shit because it's so wrong. It's one of those like, oh, sweet, that sucks that you think so. The big problem with what he's doing is, so for example, he's got one study which trains individuals for like several weeks, like I think about 3 weeks. And we know that beginners barely hypertrophy in the first couple of sessions anyway because they're undergoing so many other architectural changes, neural changes, and probably it's too much training for them anyway at that beginning. It's basically over their MRV because training itself is so shocking. You know, beginners hypertrophy from incline walking, when you give them weights, that probably exceeds their MRV right away. So he basically runs a study where he tries to get people to train with weights for a couple of weeks. Then he measures their increase in strength and increase in hypertrophy and says that the percent change in hypertrophy is almost minusculely correlated to the percent change in strength, and thus hypertrophy has nothing to do with strength. And this isn't news to anyone. It's been known that neural factors are responsible for the predominance of strength increases in the first several weeks of training. His conclusions are wildly absurd because every research scientist that knows the data also knows that those neural changes that happen early on no longer happen at the same rate later, and that a main contributing factor to strength differences between athletes who are more advanced is the degree of muscle hypertrophy they have, because neural adaptations run their course, and after a while, you just need to get bigger. You're about as efficient as you're going to get. That's why we have weight classes in sport. He said a number of other sort of really absurd things. They could, you know, it's really all the nervous system that has to do with strength, and muscle mass is really kind of irrelevant. Then, someone asked, like, you know, well, so if I lose muscle mass, can I keep strength? And he said, yeah, you can keep pretty much all of your strength. Well, so what's to prevent, you know, a super heavyweight powerlifter from cutting all the way down to, you know, 150 pounds and breaking the all-time world records by 300 pounds on each lift? Because it doesn't work like that. As you lose your muscle, you lose your strength, because the association of cross-sectional area and force production is something that people don't even debate anymore, because it was solved in a physiology lab back in 1955. I you know, it's I think he's making bombastic claims. Maybe it's to get attention or something like that. I don't think so. He seems quite genuine about it. In which case, I just think he's completely wildly wrong, and I'm actually just not very interested in any research he puts out or what he says, because when you make errors big enough, obvious enough of that magnitude, I'm unfortunately going to have to, everything you say after that is going to have to be suspect, and it's one of those things that it's just really unfortunate. I think he's a probably a really smart guy and could be doing really good work and not concluding what is not you know, clear from the studies, but he's not. And he's I was talking to a colleague of mine who can you hear me?
Yep, all good.
Talking to a colleague of mine who will remain nameless, but this particular individual sort of introduced me to the idea, which I hadn't thought about before, is that individuals like Jeremy Lenneke are actually doing a huge disservice to evidence-based coaching and evidence-based approach, because people will say, look at the ridiculous shit that guy is saying. He's supposed to be one of you scientists. He says size doesn't matter in strength. Fuck you guys. We're not going to listen to you guys. And we can't say, well, he's not really a scientist, because he's a fucking – he publishes all the time. He has a whole lab and everything. So it makes science look fucking really, really bad, terrible. So I don't know what to say about it. I think the whole situation is really fucked.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I mean, that's when you get people like Noam Chomsky talking about foreign policy, it seems. You know,
well,
he had
Noam Chomsky's not a researcher. Noam Chomsky's not an economist. He doesn't do economics research.
Conflate the two.
He's an expert. Totally. Yeah. He's an expert in his own field of linguistics. And he's been, you know, kind of talking in more sort of just as a hobbyist in economics and social policy and international relations for quite some time. So, you know, he's very deeply respected intellectual, and he's obviously clearly very smart. But we can always say, well, you know, at least economists usually aren't saying stuff like this. And you know, most economists, even leftist economists, a lot of times have to make like just nasty admissions. They'll say, well, yeah, no, okay, you know, capitalism has really produced a really good track record, but you know, we can do better with another system. They can kind of get out of it like that. But you know, Lenneke is a very, very productive scientist in the sense that he publishes often. You know, compared to him, I'm just some guy who published a couple of studies and got a teaching position and doesn't publish anymore and just writes.
Well, to that point, though, I was listening to the Jug Life podcast with you and Jared Feather, and my formal degree is in economics. I have a CSCS because I wanted to get one. But you were talking about the difference between exercise physiology and sport physiology. And as somebody who doesn't have like an academic background, I had never even considered there's even a difference. And I think that follows, you know, exercise physiology being more lab-based and sport physiology being much more coaching and performance-oriented.
Yeah, I guess you could say Lenneke is stretching into sport physiology without any understanding of it. But I think he's actually stretching... His conception of exercise physiology is already wrong. I mean, the kind of errors in logic he's making, just it's a really weird situation. You know, I'm over here having arguments with other people saying that they're undervaluing how much hypertrophy occurs in the first couple of months of training, because some individuals will say, you know, barely any hypertrophy occurs at all for 6 weeks. And I think they're a little wrong, not wholly wrong. And then when Jeremy Lenneke and I were discussing this on social media, actually, he was like, well, you know, most hypertrophy is going to occur within 6 months anyway. And I was like, do you mean that? And he was like, yeah, sure do. That just hit me a left field. I was like, I didn't even know there's anyone that considers that as a possibility. I mean, can you imagine, you know, talking to, so forget about drugs for a second. Let's just go to natural bodybuilders, you know? Can you imagine, like, natural bodybuilders? Like, just go to a natural bodybuilder show. Everyone's jacked.
Oh, what a nightmare.
And being like, so how many years have you guys been training? The average is going to be, like, somewhere between, you know, 10 and 20. Right. And you'd be like, so you guys were probably just about this big after 6 months, right? I mean, if you go around and talk to people and you say that, they're going to think you're joking. Everyone's going to think you're joking unless right. someone's completely humorless. And then they're going to be like, are you crazy? And you're going to be like, no, I'm just fucking around. But you could be like, no, I really, that's what the research shows. And they'd be like, that's completely insane. It can, I don't even know. I'll tell you what. So in my own perspective, after the first 6 months of my training, I went from 100 pounds to 120 pounds.
I can't imagine you ever being 100 pounds, but okay.
Yeah, it was a real thing. So what the fuck, right? Like, how did I put on another 100? You know, it doesn't make any sense.
Right,
so
exactly.
After someone says something like that, I'm just actually just pretty much not interested in hearing their opinion on a whole lot of other topics.
Well, fair enough. So I want to move along. How much time do you have? I don't want to chew into too much of your time.
Another 20, 30 minutes.
Cool, awesome. So I wanted to come back to something you talked about earlier, trade-offs. And opportunity cost. And I guess I'll start off with just the concept of opportunity cost being, you know, for any choice you make, the opportunity cost is the next best alternative. So maybe you've done some writing about kind of, as far as bodybuilding is concerned, spending time, you know, spending whole mesocycles just trying to bring up one area and then shifting to another body part, and you're going to have to make trade-offs there. I think that highlights the importance of a yearly plan, and I'd love to hear some of the strategies you've used in your own training as far as managing those types of trade-offs.
Well, your first thing about trade-offs is that the concept of trade-offs is not a concept anyone is really excited about, because the precondition for trade-offs is a set of limited resources. As long as you have limited resources, being that recovery ability, time, food, anything, then you have to understand that everything you want is much bigger of a pile than the funnel through which you put everything you can have. So
I would say patience. Have you ever heard the quote, patience is a virtue of the gods that have nothing but time?
Nice. Yeah, somebody very impatient must have said that.
I forget who it was.
So in any case, you know, you've got to think of what is the best current use of my time and other things I could be doing better. You get to a point, if you're more intermediate / advanced, where if you are still able to train your whole body above the minimum effective volume of all the body parts, so you're still getting growth, that total recovery demand of all the body parts being pushed at the same time might eventually get so high that you're just not able to train everything super hard, because as you train things harder and harder and harder, the total recovery demand of each individual muscle group being pushed to overload summed together, it starts to become higher than the overall recovery ability of the total body. And at that point, you have to say, okay, so I can't actually just get stronger at squats and benches and deadlifts and curls and pull-ups and everything all at the same time. Beginners can. Intermediates can do so slowly. Advanced people can either do so slowly, or their sum total of the MRVs of all their body parts are a number higher than the total body MRV. So it's impossible to actually make the sum total minimum effective volumes of all the body parts are higher than the total body's MRV, which means that by definition, in order to get some growth out of any body part, you have to take other body parts down to their MV or their maintenance volume. That means you just hold a couple of body parts. Maybe easy analogy is hold your lower body training at just maintenance to free up recovery ability for your whole body so that you can run your upper body through its own actual, you know, minimum effective volume all the way up to MRV and cycling back through those to get productive gains. Some people, when they hear that, I actually get this a lot on social media, and this is feedback from a variety of individuals that that consume my work. They'll hear that and they'll say, well, you know, there's got to be a way around that, and they're basically not comfortable with the idea of trade-offs, nor should they be. We should always look for situations in which trade-offs either don't have to be severe or which we don't have to make them, because some things like just improving your nutrition actually just raises your total body MRV period. Sure. And you might not have to make that trade-off, but at some point the trade-off has to be made. And a lot of people kind of fight for too long and try to figure out, well, what if I get really creative and, you know, 1 week I train this really hard, the next week I train that. And basically you realize it's coming from an emotional place with them. It's an addiction to seeing everything progress all the time. It's an addiction they developed when they were beginners and they carried through their intermediate years. And now that they're more advanced, they can't dump the addiction. It's like individuals whom you have to tell that, okay, we're either going to be building muscle and a bit of fat, or we're going to be burning fat but not building muscle at the same time. And they say, no, I want to do both. And you're like, well, I understand everyone wants to do both, but you're no longer beginner enough. You have to make trade-offs because your total ability to do something is being, you know, capped by the individual sort of subcomponents of that. And it's a shitty thing, but it's got to be accepted. If you're not comfortable with the idea of trade-offs, then you're going to be in for a lot of confusion and attempting things that don't work.
So where do you think, why do you think that's so much more difficult to do in, you know, strength athletes and physique athletes, as opposed to say, you know, you practice jujitsu, or, you know, a basketball player, for example? You can't add, you can't work on every single part of your game all the time. You know, a basketball player is much more willing to add two or three moves to their repertoire over the summer versus a bodybuilder who just, you know, almost emotionally just refuses to make those trade-offs. Where do you think that comes from? Do you think it's like a body dysmorphia type thing, or just, you know, not wanting to accept your limitations?
So you're proposing the idea that bodybuilders have this more excessively than other athletes?
I think it seems to me that way. Maybe not.
I'm not sure. I don't have the data to make that supposition. I don't have the impression to make that supposition. I actually just don't know.
Fair enough.
But I can speak to why bodybuilders have a tough time with it, because bodybuilders got into the sport because of the idea of progress in the most kind of positive cases.
Sure.
Not having progress in a certain area, fundamentally, it means goal you are working on is not being achieved. In the not so great cases, and there are some of that, people aren't into bodybuilding so much to progress as they are to duck the demons of regression and what their body used to look like. They're not going for a goal of looking great. They're running away from a goal of looking terrible. And every time a body part of theirs is not getting overloaded and not growing, they're not doing enough to push away from that always encroaching darkness that wants to bring them back to looking like shit, which is what they used to look like, and they took it really personally, and then they never recovered. So, you know, even the positive approach to bodybuilding, which is kind of a growth mindset, has that where, okay, you know what, you may be okay with it, but at the very least, you got to admit you're not growing, and that's not great. And then the negative approach of trying to leave behind looking bad.
Yeah, I mean,
that's really clearly obvious why people don't want to do priority phases. Because you talk to a guy and you say, listen, I know you like to work on your back, and I know you like to see your back improve. But if you really want to see your chest improve, and I know you've been struggling with that, you got to train your chest more and your back less for a while. And they'll say, so I can't train my back as hard as I always do. No, I can't get these super gnarly pumps. No, I can't hit PRs on pull-ups and bent rows for a couple of weeks. No. Well, fuck that. I don't want to do that. So, or they'll try it and they'll just regress right back because they miss it, you know?
Right. To me, this kind of framework of approaching the sport of bodybuilding fits so perfectly with the difference between short run and long run, you know, economics. Short run being, you know, one or more production. So you're a company making widgets. The short run is when one or more production variables are fixed, and the long run is when all production variables are kind of up for grabs, so to speak. And I think this speaks to, you know, the short run mindset of, you know, keeping a couple things fixed while being able to improve on other things. And then in the long run, you know, it kind of, you know, a 10, 15 year training career, as much as it might be difficult to step back and see the forest from the trees a little bit, you know, that's really what you got to keep your eye on, or the in the back of your mind a little bit.
For sure, and it depends on to what extent you train for immediate therapy or for long-term goal acquisition. I think a lot of people train for therapy. It makes them feel good, and they train at a deeper level. Their therapy is seeing improvement. I was speaking to another coach, and he said he has his clients PR in some way every time they're at the gym. They hit some kind of PR anytime right. they're at the gym. And what a ridiculous addiction to PRs. I mean, you got these people basically who are emotionally so fragile. Two steps forward, one step back, forget about it. They can't even do two steps right. forward, one step's holding, right? Right. And some people, if that's their basis of training, they got to really kind of re-ask themselves why they train. If it's to hit PRs, you know, they could just kind of design an arbitrary board game in which every time you roll the dice, you quote unquote get more points in the game. That'll satisfy their, you know, their proclivity for infinite expansion. Right. And maybe they're in the wrong sport in bodybuilding. If you want to be the best or as good as you can be, or if you have an objective desire to look a certain way, you got to jettison emotion to a large extent and do what is logical and scientific. And a lot of times that stuff isn't super fun to do. So,
well, so actually, on the short film that you guys put out, or that was put out around you and how you got into training and your experience going through undergrad and master's and all that stuff, I've commented making serial killer discipline or making serial killer level precision great again. And like that just idea of shifting your idea of like what's intense to something that's more sustainable has, I cannot tell you how much that has like changed my whole life. Like 3 years ago now, I blew out 3 discs and I crushed my hip doing yokes within 7 days of each other. So I was out for a couple months and all that stuff. And that's when I decided to get my CSCS and like read all the fucking textbooks and just actually figure out what I was doing and not just train like a maniac all the time. And
it's a good idea.
And that's why I started getting into your work and Ben's work. And it just, I had to shift my idea of what's intense and like what's cool versus what looks dope on Instagram and all that type of
stuff.
So
what used to be your idea of what's cool versus what is it now?
In the past, it was just getting super amped for like every workout was the battle for Middle Earth. And I come from a martial arts like an MMA kickboxing background. So just super aggressive all the time, as opposed to being, and now it's much more like, you know, if there's even a couple degrees of upward motion in my bent over rows, like I'm unhappy about that. Just, or if I swing in a weighted pull up at all, that bugs me. As opposed to like, you know, if I do a 50 pound dumbbell for 5 sets of 5 on weighted pull-ups, you know, I could probably do 60, but it's just not going to give me the same results. Like I've allocated my discipline towards what the most sustainable thing is for a 10 to 15 year training career. I've just changed what I think is intense because, you know, what I love about training. Yeah. And I think that, I've talked about this a lot and I'm still working through it in my head, but really mastery of anything. I come from a music background too. Like I play all the instruments. I've been recording music my whole life. And it's really like mastery of any discipline is a super submissive process. And it's doubly as awkward in strength and in sports, especially bodybuilding and strength sports, because it's like the act is so aggressive that really taking a submissive attitude towards the process is this weird juxtaposition. I haven't totally like worked it out in my head yet, the idea, but working on it.
Yeah, it's really easy to put it all in perspective when you just re-ask why you are doing what you're doing. is what you're doing logically right. the best idea from a sustainable perspective for long-term results? If the answer is yes, you're doing the right thing. And it doesn't really matter what anyone else is doing around you or what they say or how you feel about it. You can always just run that logical test. Am I doing the right thing for long-term success? If yes, great. If no, right. change.
Well, that's why I think it's important. You know, you want to go back to talking about what's best for the evidence-based community. Having the mix of the labs. I watched a good chunk of the evidence-based roundtable that you did with Eric Helms. Or was that you with Eric? I forget who was on that. But it was just an evidence-based roundtable talking about kind of what it means to be have the literature part and what it means to have the you know the anecdotal in the trenches stuff. And I think that's for people who aren't so literature driven and they just want to consume kind of what you guys, the information you guys are putting out. That's why I think coming from guys like you and Chad Wesley Smith, who's squatting a bajillion pounds and you know, all that kind of stuff. I think that's just so important.
Yeah. There aren't a lot of the last thing. There aren't a lot of people left that are arguing against that approach. I think that's the ultimate approach is to have both perspectives. And I think if you are of, you know, I'm one of those that's kind of in the middle where I'm pretty good at science. I'm pretty good at being jacked, but I'm not amazing at either one. Amazing at either one, you have to give respect and recognition to the other side, you know? So you just super jacked bodybuilder, no scientific background can kind of say, look, science has a lot to tell us and I don't know it all. And then somebody who studies a lot in a lab and doesn't have a ton of real world practice can say, look, you know, my lab stuff is great. I think you should be using it, but I think that you really got to make sure it checks out with what the biggest people are.
I think matters
to some extent
too is that you're a good speaker. Like that's the third part of the equation is being able to educate. You know, you can
into educating.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like the evidence-based community is on this precipice of like getting outside of its own echo chamber. You know, and that's part of one of the things I want to do with GymSpot is I want to create like a real consumer product that's more of a utility that people can use and then kind of dilute the real science evidence-based stuff into more consumer and try to kind of open the gates, so to speak, open the levees up from our community to the layman who's just trying to find a new gym to go to or a parent who's trying to find a sport organization for their kid. I think we need to find, hey man, what's the worst that happens? It doesn't go as smoothly as I want it to. Kind of the last thing I want to talk about are our book recommendations. And I want to hear your thoughts, especially as a professor, why textbooks are important.
Well,
and why reading articles on the internet just isn't as good as actually reading a textbook is. Because I just got out of, I mean, I'm recently graduated college, and while I probably should have gone to class more than I did okay because I read the fucking book. And none of my classmates seem to do that very often, and they wonder why they got shitty grades on the test. Like, well, did you read the thing, you know? So I'd love to hear your thoughts on the value of textbooks.
Yeah, so a textbook does a couple of things really well. A textbook is a teaching tool designed to take you from knowing pretty close to nothing except the prerequisite subjects and to learning a ton. It does so in a pedagogical manner as opposed to a random manner, which is very important. And the second thing it does well is it gives you a comprehensive view of the current state of knowledge of the subject. You can get into really unfortunate situations with knowledge if you seek out your own articles and read 20 articles and think, this is great. I know this stuff really well. The problem is, of the 20 articles you read, 15 were biased into one direction and 5 were biased into another. A It turns out that the total net of the science at the time, there was 100 articles published, and the rest of the 80 that you didn't read were biased into the direction of the 5 that were a minority in your sample. And the 15 you read on the one perspective are the only 15. So it turns out that the majority of the view, the more correct approach, is that what you consider the minority view, or maybe not even exposed to. So a textbook, because it is based on essentially comprehensive reviews of the literature, and then explains them for you, it allows you to get a comprehensive view from the foundation all the way to the tip of the skyscraper. And it's a guided tour of the field. In addition to that, unlike a documentary or a video, a textbook is something that you can read for a bit, look at the diagrams on your own time, think through it, put the connections together in your head, then continue reading, as opposed to listening to a video or something, where sometimes they say some things and you're like, oh, that's not going to make sense. But then he's talking about new shit and you're just listening to the new shit.
Right.
So
I think it also affords people, I mean, generally speaking, textbooks have, you know, those little quizzes at the end. Self-testing, in my opinion, is one of the most underutilized tools for students in college, or, you know, anybody trying to learn anything. Self-testing is critical.
I mean, I learned almost everything I know from textbooks, certainly the basics, and I did every single quiz at the end of every single chapter. I looked forward to it as a fun challenge. And yeah, I mean, that's one of those things where the textbook isn't there randomly. It's not just another resource. It was exclusively designed to teach you as well as possible. How could I not recommend textbooks? You know,
what kind of recommendations do you have if, you know, for people looking to really get the, you know, the first principles kind of sport physiology textbooks? What would you have to recommend?
Where are they coming from as far as their background education?
You know, they lifted weights recreationally. Their degree is something other than in sports science, and they just, you know, they want to start from the bottom, so to speak. So, you know, they've been around the gym. They know general, you know, I got to work hard to get better, but that's pretty much it.
And how much do they want to know? How deep do they want to take their knowledge?
I don't know. I guess that's a good point.
Because if you want to go real deep, go ahead.
Yeah, like say you wanted to be a coach. You wanted to be an Instagram FitFam coach, but you wanted to do it more responsibly maybe than just understanding what macros are.
Yeah, I mean, I would, anatomy and physiology textbook, would pick one up and learn that. If you can't understand what it's saying, you need to learn biology first. Then anatomy and physiology, and then whatever you want to do, there's textbooks associated with it usually. If you want to coach athletes, I would pick up the NSCA Strength and Conditioning Manual, whatever latest edition. If you want to understand hypertrophy, you pick up Brad Schoenfeld's hypertrophy textbook. If you want to do sport nutrition, there's a lot of options, but Sport Nutrition by Eukendrup and Gleason is a modern text that covers most of the bases. And then after that, you're well enough solidified in your base to know the basics, and then you can start reading articles and coaching opinions and literature reviews. You'll have enough of a background to piece together the rest of the applied side, but your basic side should be covered pretty well.
Sure. Yeah. And then as far as economic textbooks are concerned, I would say my favorite textbook that I read on economics was Exchange and Production by Alchian and Allen. I don't know if you've ever read that one, but they have a pretty good sense of humor, so it's easier to get through than maybe some of the other economic textbooks. And really anything, I know you're a Thomas Sowell fan, really anything by Thomas Sowell is going to be a pretty good read. I just started.
I think that if you're not a trained economist, probably one of the best places to start if you want to familiarize yourself with economics is Thomas Sowell's classic Basic Economics. And speaks in non-technical language and teaches you the basic principles of economics so that you can think for yourself about them. And, you know, after reading that book, if you want to do, you know, N. Gregory Mankiw's, you know, one of his 50 trillion basic economics textbooks for undergraduates, he's been publishing that for like 40 years or something. That's a good place to start. I would even recommend Paul Krugman's early 90s and 2000s textbooks. He used Paul Krugman. Go ahead.
Have you read Wealth, Poverty, and Politics yet? I'm starting it this weekend.
Who wrote that?
So the big red cover.
Oh, Thomas Sowell's new book?
Yeah.
No, I haven't. I haven't. I've been so busy that I haven't read much. I haven't read for fun much. The last book I read for fun was Steven Pinker's book about the history of violence throughout.
I haven't read that, but I like him as a character. So I guess the last question I want to ask you, especially who's like you guys, I think would get along great. You just seem to know everything about fucking everything. First of all, he wants to congratulate you on your purple belt.
Who is this?
Elliot Atwell.
Oh, okay.
You may or may not have interacted with him on Facebook. He's pretty active on that stuff. Super genius kid. Somebody I've looked up to a lot. He wants to know what your thoughts on the balance between optimal programming for muscle growth or body recomposition and program adherence long term. What do you think kind of a good balance is there?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for the congratulations, Elliot, on the purple belt. That's pretty cool. Yeah, I have a good answer for that. So basically what you want to do is when you first start training, you want to probably train something like 3 days a week, whole body. Compound lifts, not super challenging, work on technique. You'll get great results because you're a beginner. And you'll ingrain really good patterns. And you won't overwhelm yourself with too many technicalities. Your eating should be just eat plenty of protein, eat plenty of food, and you'll be good. And that's as much detail as I think you should put into it for the first months and or years. My dedication to nutrition was decent when I was like an undergrad, but I didn't, you know, I ate a lot of burritos and peanut butter and jelly sandwiches with protein shakes and not something you could call bodybuilding food, but I was consistent about eating plenty of food.
Right.
And that's the most important thing about getting big anyway. And that as your gain rates slow down, and concomitantly, as your passion for getting more jacked and more lean grows, you start to thread in more detail and more effort. You start to maybe look at food groups other than protein and the rest of food. You maybe try to eat in a more regulated meal structure. Maybe try some shakes with training. Maybe you start to train 4 days a week, maybe five, and you do a little bit more body prioritizing. And as you continue to progress, you add in more details. Now, if someone was a robot, would you train them perfectly from day one and have them track their nutrition to every variable within from day one? Yes. But a lot of people tend to burn out doing that. So I think it's a good approach to kind of ease into the game, because you'll only lose, you know, a couple of years, maybe a year or two's worth of progress that way, but you'll gain a decade or two of consistency.
Sure.
You know, at this point, you know, my passion for training and getting jacked and getting lean is so extreme. I would gladly trade years of my life for more muscle. And, you know, that's when you can say that, you'll do anything it takes as far as working daily, your diet, manipulations, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But I didn't start out like that. I didn't even like training when I started out. And I sure as hell would never be able to follow a nutrition plan when I was in high school. So I think a lot of people jump in too soon. So my answer to what the trade-off is work into them slowly. And the trade-off is with time. So as time continues on and as you become more passionate, do what is within your realm of passion to allow you to do.
Right.
And if you become unpassionate about it, just quit the sport because it gives a shit. It's just a hobby anyway.
Right. A lot of my athletes are actually like 40, 50, 60-year-olds looking in to get into this thing called powerlifting because they saw it on Instagram and thought it was cool. And whenever we start tracking food, I always start with just track your food. You know, whenever we find their kind of calorie intake, I say track your food for 2 weeks. Don't think about what you eat. Measure it against your body weight and see what we are then. Then, you know, for the first kind of mesocycle, we're just starting with trying to hit a calorie goal. And then we just try to hit the calorie goal and then the protein for the next mesocycle. I kind of almost periodize them on up into tracking their macronutrients because, you know, I remember the first month I tried to track my macros, even after having been super serious about my nutrition in the past, and I was just so overwhelmed. It just, it was a little discouraging.
Totally.
Awesome. All right. Well, Dr. Mike, thank you so much for your time. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. I think hopefully this sparks some people to be interested in economics and maybe gets them to think about some things in a different way.
Yahoo. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, boss. Have a great weekend.
All right. Thanks. Take care.